The COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the stress and burnout, the anxiety and grueling fatigue that medical professionals have endured these last 18 months. We've seen pictures of physicians with mask creases cut into their tired faces. We've heard from nurses who've lost an unbearable number of patients. We've clapped for exhausted grocery store workers and filled Amazon wish lists for overstretched teachers. But have there been organized cheering sessions for prison guards or folks on the line at meatpacking plants? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. There are certain jobs that many of us would never dream of doing and frankly would rather not think about. The same jobs that keep our country and economy humming along at the clip many of us have come to expect. Author and journalist A.L. Press explores how he condemns some workers' chosen paths while tacitly endorsing them in his new book. It's called Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And he joins us now to talk about it. A.L., welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So let's start with this idea of dirty work and its kind of unconscious mandate. First of all, what exactly is it that makes work dirty?
Yeah, so I think that most people, when they hear the expression dirty work, think of just an unpleasant task that is sort of physically dirtying, like collecting the garbage off the street. But in my book, I'm talking about dirty work in a different sense. And I define dirty work as a morally troubling activity that society depends on and tacitly condones, but doesn't want to hear too much about. So if we think of, as you know, we've seen in the pandemic, a lot of stories about slaughterhouses, you know, working on the kill floor of a slaughterhouse is something that even most meat eaters don't want to think about too much or see up close, or the work that goes into running the prisons and jails in the United States, which are part of the world's largest prison system. And again, there is, on the one hand, a sort of necessary aspect to these jobs. You sort of can't imagine society functioning without someone doing them. On the other hand, many people want to sort of keep these jobs at arm's length and delegate them to other people to do because they're both psychologically and emotionally challenging.
So who are the people who most often find themselves working these types of jobs?
Yeah, so, a central theme of my book is inequality. And when we think about inequality, we often think about the concentration of wealth, the 1% and the 99%. But I'm talking about inequality in terms of who gets delegated the dirty work in America, who ends up doing the jobs that have a sort of psychic and emotional toll to them, but that someone needs to do. And generally speaking, it's not society's elites. It's not the privileged and the powerful. It's people from lower rungs on the social ladder, undocumented immigrants who work in industrial slaughterhouses, or people in small towns that have lost their mills and factories, and where the local jail is now the best job opportunity around. So dirty work is organized and arranged in a way that the bulk of the work ends up going to the less advantaged. And I think that along with secrecy, that's one of the reasons that a lot of folks in society who are more privileged can kind of, not pay too much attention to it.
So the first part of the book focuses on people who work on psychiatric wards of prisons. Before we get into that section, it's important to point out that jails and prisons are kind of major psychiatric care providers these days, right?
Yeah, and that's really what I focus on. It's one thing to as I think anyone would say, you know, a jail or a prison is a place, an institution in just about any society you can imagine where crimes occur. But in our country, we have come to rely on jails and prisons, I suggest, to serve as de facto mental health asylums. They are, in fact, the largest mental health institutions in every state at this point. And what that results in is some very treacherous and difficult work conditions, not only for prison guards who often have no training in dealing with people with severe mental illnesses, but also for the mental health aides, which is where my book starts. You know, how are they to provide care to people in an environment that is violent, polarized, and unfortunately often rife with abuse.
So talk to me a little bit about the idea of deinstitutionalization. You know, there was a big backlash against having like psychiatric facilities many, many, many decades ago. And it kind of paved the way for jails and prisons to become where we warehouse folks who are mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, I think that movement, you know, in my reading, was a very well-intentioned movement that crystallized around the idea of doing better for people with severe mental illnesses. There were just, you know, there were a lot of exposés in the media about just the really inhumane conditions in many mental health asylums. And what's ironic here is if you go back to the 19th century and Dorothea Dix and some of the reformers who initially were working on this, she found, again, back in the early 19th century in America, that the mentally ill were being left in jails and prisons and sort of found this just, you know, so inhumane that we needed to do better. So she called for building, you know, these state mental health hospitals and asylums. Well, we built those, but by the 1960s and 70s, the conditions in those institutions had really declined. And people said, let's provide community care. Let's give folks with mental illnesses a chance to live in the community, but also get mental health services when they need them. Unfortunately, the follow through on providing those community health services, particularly in poor communities in this country, did not come through. And so as a consequence, we sort of rely, you know, I look in depth at the state of Florida. And Florida at the time that I'm writing, this is, you know, 5-6 years ago, was second last in the country in spending on mental health services. And meanwhile, it had the third largest prison system in the country. And a lot of the people cycling through the jails and prisons were folks who would be better off getting, you know, mental health services in a different environment. But it didn't exist. And so that creates this, you know, problem that then what I call the dirty workers are on the receiving end of, where they have to figure out, you know, what do we do in this situation?
So you spent a lot of time getting to know folks who had worked at the transitional care unit at the Dade Correctional Institution in Florida. Who works there? It's not just psychiatrists and guards, right? There are a lot of people who work there.
Yeah, there are nurses, there are mental health aides. The transitional care unit is the mental health ward of the prison you mentioned, Dade, which is not far from Miami, and yet it's invisible to most people in Miami, as most prisons are, and indeed as most dirty work is. And what ends up happening is I follow a couple of the mental health aides who work in that prison and who slowly discover that the patients in their care, entrusted to their care, are being mistreated. They're being skipped meals. They're being verbally and sometimes physically abused. And the abuse sort of intensifies and rises to a really extreme degree. And all the way along, these mental health aides are having to decide, you know, what should we do? Should we report what's happening or not? Because even as some of them wish to report it, they are also dependent on the guards in the facility for their own safety. So this creates a sort of dilemma, dual loyalty for these workers. And I think it's one of the reasons that many elite psychiatrists don't want to work in prisons. They know that this is a very, you know, treacherous environment to work in.
So explain a little bit more, if you will, about why workers inside a unit like this might be hesitant to report abuse. You say they're reliant on the guards for safety and protection. Why wouldn't they all have the same kind of goal in mind? Why aren't they all just working towards the same standards? Why are people afraid to report abuse?
Well, I can just personalize it through the story of one of the mental health aides, Harriet Kriskovsky, I tell her story early in the book, and she, early on, as she was sort of discovering that, you know, things, she noticed, for example, that that the guys in her group were not being allowed out to the rec yard on Sunday, and one of her jobs was to take them out there. This was their only fresh air, and she kept being told for different reasons they can't go out there, and she ends up reporting this just in an email to her, to her supervisor. Soon thereafter, she's doing a group therapy session, and the guard at the door suddenly disappears. So Harriet is there alone with a group of prisoners, and as a woman working in an all-male prison, she feels unsafe. She starts walking through the rec yard and realizing she's alone. And one time when she's in the rec yard, again, alone, a prisoner inappropriately starts touching her and nearly assaults her. And so the message is sent to her very early on, you know, don't do or say something that gets in the way of security. And again, some of the security guards there she's friends with and are doing their best to do, you know, to manage things in a humane way, but some of the guards are not doing that. And she finds that if she says anything about it, they're going to single her out and retaliate.
There's a sneering little bit of inside jargon in these chapters that I found really interesting and had never heard before. What is a hug-a-thug?
That is exactly what some of the guards call the mental health aides who they feel are too sympathetic to the prisoners, who believe the complaints they raise, who, you know, in a sense, become their advocates rather than, being wary of them. And initially, Harriet actually doesn't find that an unfair criticism. In fact, she thinks she shouldn't be an advocate for these patients. She should just kind of remain neutral. She felt and thought and assumed the guards were with her and on her side. But as she witnesses this abuse, she starts to question that, and she starts to really have a kind of inner dilemma about, you know, how to do her job.
So will you explain a little bit more about why many people make the argument that the folks who run and guard prisons are our agents? What does that mean?
Yeah, so I take that concept from a sociologist named Everett Hughes, who wrote an essay back in 1962, actually, and it was called Good People and Dirty Work. And the basic point of the essay is that there is dirty work in all systems. And we like to think of the people who do it, particularly if it disturbs us, if it's something sort of really morally troubling, we'd like to think of them as rogue actors who are just kind of acting on their own. But in fact, the people who do the dirty work in every society are, Hughes suggests, agents of many good people who rely on what they do and who kind of tacitly approve of it, but just don't want to be asked about it. And Hughes, you know, wrote this essay, I should say, drawing on a very extreme case. He went to post-war Germany and he talked to what he considered the good people. These were people who had lived through the Nazi era, but who were, you know, cosmopolitan architects and writers and teachers and journalists, and who told him they were ashamed of what the Nazis had done, but who then simultaneously said to him, but you know, the Jews, they really were a problem. And something had to be done to settle this problem. And they spoke in these very derogatory ways about Jews as kind of outsiders. And that's how Hughes kind of got this idea that, hey, wait a minute, the good people want to disavow this dirty work, but actually they also sort of felt this was a problem that needed to be taken care of. And how uncommon is that? And he suggests in this essay, it's not uncommon at all. In fact, it's a dynamic that exists in our own society. He was an American sociologist who taught at the University of Chicago.
It's also interesting to note that you learned a lot about just correctional officers and prison guards and other facilities. The first question I want to ask is, why are so many correctional facilities in rural areas in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, to get back to the theme of inequality, I talked about how dirty work is generally not done by the powerful and the privileged. That's true of psychiatrists. It's not elite psychiatrists who work in prisons. Prison guards and the folks who get jobs as security guards in prisons often come from small towns and rural areas because that's where a lot of the jails and prisons in America have been built. And, you know, in the 70s and 80s, And in the beginning, it should be said that the literature on this shows that you know, many communities didn't actually initially, you know, thrill to the idea of having a correctional facility built. But when you have a lack of other jobs, when say the mills and factories have left, and you know, it became a growth industry in this country, particularly during the era that led to and created, you know, mass incarceration. And although that's slightly less, there's certainly less enthusiasm for mass incarceration today. I think it's being questioned across the political spectrum in a lot of, you know, towns and rural areas in America. The local jail is still an important source of jobs.
You make the point in the book that the salary correctional officers are paid actually kind of reinforces how their jobs are seen as lowly.
Well, I mean, it does vary by state a little bit. So there are states like California and New York where, you know, prison guards sort of became, you know, joint unions. The unions got a lot of power. They decided they wanted to be called correctional officers rather than prison guards, which itself, there's a whole sort of lineage of terms that, you know, have been used to describe guards that have been seen by the folks who work in prisons as demeaning, you know, as insulting, a turnkey, a screw. And so some of this has changed a little bit in some states, but in many states, Florida included, where I looked in depth, but certainly many others, it's not well paying. The main thing that it does have is some benefits that go with it. But it is what, you know, many think of as a job of last resort, a job with less prestige than, say, you know, being an officer of the law in some other way. And indeed, many of the correctional officers I spoke to were folks who told me they had wanted to be cops or they had wanted to do something else, but they ended up being prison guards.
Why are guards sometimes referred to as the other prisoners?
That's a term that I noticed and sort of saw scattered in. I found it in an old study published a couple decades ago, and I used it as the chapter title to one of the chapters in my book. And I think it's because you know, there are two ways to think about prison guards. One is just as the people with the power in a prison or a jail. The ones who control everything and who have, you know, all of the privileges and benefits that the prisoners, the incarcerated people, do not have. But there's another way to look at them, which is that, you know, even if they do have certainly more freedom and power than the incarcerated folks, they are spending their day in the same environment. They are working in this, you know, crowded, often violent, and often tense environment. And if you look at the occupational health studies of prison guards, I delve into that a bit, you see very high rates of suicide, of PTSD, of you know, divorce and substance addiction. That all goes with a job that is very stressful and of low prestige, not recognized. You know, one guard dramatized this to me by talking about how his brother was a cop, and he said, you know, whenever a cop dies in the line of duty, there's a public funeral, and it's noted on the news. When a prison guard dies, nobody notices.
I want to transition now to talk a little bit about the drone program that's a part of the military. For folks not familiar with how it works, how does someone kind of find their way into this program, like getting a job as an imagery analyst, for example?
Well, I think like so many of the jobs I look at in this book, at least in the cases I looked at, this was not, you know, the highest aspiration of the imagery analyst that I wrote about, a woman named Heather Linebow. She sort of stumbled into it because she wanted to get out of the small town she was in Pennsylvania. And for not all, but for many folks, the military is, you know, represents opportunity where opportunity is lacking, the opportunity to get an education, the opportunity to travel, the opportunity to get professional skills, and some measure of prestige. And so, you know, some imagery analysts in the drone program end up, you know, finding out that what the job itself is actually isn't conventional warfare. it's the new form of warfare that has become more and more common in the last, you know, 2 decades, and that is, you know, distance warfare, sitting at a screen, watching, you know, the aerial footage from a drone, and playing some role in what the military calls the kill chain, you know, the chain of decisions that will lead either to a strike being carried out or not being carried out.
So many of these workers, when they start the job, you know, they may have different reactions to it. You describe one man who kind of felt a little bit of adrenaline and euphoria and being involved in something that seems so significant to the war effort. But many folks report pretty crushing signs of physical distress as they get deeper into those jobs.
Yeah, and I should say the folks who report that have also reported it to the military itself. So the studies that I cite in the book, in which there are very high rates of stress and what are referred to as adverse, you know, difficult emotions that are connected to the service and the type of service this is. Those are internal studies that the military itself has done, in part because they've seen high rates of burnout in this program. Folks just, you know, really finding it hard to do this day after day, week after week, year after year. And so I visit some drone bases and talk to some chaplains and psychologists who were quite open about the emotional stresses. And I think that those stresses are, you know, again, very related to the fact that we have a misperception about, you know, drone warfare. The outside public, I think, sometimes thinks of it as a video game. But the people who are doing it, you know, they're seeing some very vivid imagery of violence. They're seeing killing. They're seeing, buildings that have blown up. And imagine seeing that day after day and then going back to civilian life, you know, an hour later. That sort of jarring transition is part of what these chaplains and psychologists talked about when they tried to, you know, capture why it can be an extremely stressful job.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you more about that. The idea, some people have said, well, you know, drone operators are going to have this kind of PlayStation mentality to killing. It's all a game. It's a joystick. It's not real. But that concern hasn't really proved out to be valid, right? I mean, that is not how killing affects the people involved in the drone program.
No, not at all. I think that you know, is, you know, understandably seen as sort of an insulting myth by the people who have been in the program. And, you know, I think that, again, to sort of get to how did we get here, right? Why drone warfare? Well, on one level, it's because, you know, as a society, we fought these long, expansive, and expensive ground wars, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan. And I think that, you know, there was a lack of desire to continue that. The public didn't want to see more American soldiers, you know, casualties piling up, you know, trillions of dollars spent and so forth. And drones seemed like an easy solution. But it's not so easy for the people doing it. You know, again, for some of the reasons that I talked about, you know, and that these chaplains and psychologists mentioned. And what's really, you know, striking about it is that, you know, if you're not on the battlefield itself, then you're dealing with a different kind of injury than the traditional conventional soldier. You know, we know about PTSD, which is a kind of fear response to a near-death experience, or to, you know, to being really in the throes of the battle, right? But these are people who are not in the throes of the battle. And yet what lingers, you know, in talking to folks, what lingers and what sort of can be difficult to live with is, you know, that strike that hit that that target that we said was one target, why were there multiple coffins the next day carried through that area? Or just seeing afterwards villagers picking through the rubble and wondering, you know, was the right person hit? Was this, you know, sort of precision strike really as precise as we all think?
And I do want to go back to that point you made about how close this is to normal civilian life. You know, you're not overseas in a combat unit with a bunch of people living with them you know, they do the same thing you do every day, and you have a kind of camaraderie and a shared experience that you kind of steep yourself in when you're abroad. A lot of these people literally go home from a drone strike work day to pick up milk at the store or hit up the kids' soccer games right after.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, in much of what's been written about, you know, what soldiers fight for and what, you know, leads to incredible acts of courage and sacrifice in some cases, it's generally they're fighting for their fellow soldiers, you know, the people who are with them, the camaraderie, the sense of esprit de corps. And, you know, it was again mentioned to me when I was doing this reporting, you don't have that in the same sense when you're you know, going to a drone base and then leaving your cubicle and then going back to civilian life. One of the bases I visited was very near Las Vegas, and it was really jarring to be on that base just for a couple of hours, and then to go back and see, you know, at the time this was pre-COVID, just see people, you know, reveling and partying and gambling. And just to think, you know, an hour or two away, that's still happening. If it was jarring for me, I can only imagine how jarring it is for the folks who do it every day.
And like you said before, obviously, like, emotional distress has been well documented within this program. But there are some extreme examples in this book of just crushing physical symptoms that came with it, too. Right. You had people with, you know, recurrent, you know, chronic back pain who are grinding their teeth to the point that a molar was breaking. I mean, these jobs were breaking people down so that they were nearly unrecognizable to family members and friends.
Yeah. One person in the drone program I interviewed at length is Christopher Aaron. And Chris is a very robust, physically fit guy. He was a high school wrestling star. And he did a couple of stints just early on, actually, in the drone program. And then he was in Afghanistan, and he started to have doubts about how the war was going. And he was, by the way, one of the people who, in the initial days, when he would see a strike hit a target, he was, you know, really, he felt that adrenaline. And he also felt like the bad guys had been hit in his mind. He starts to doubt that on this trip to Afghanistan, because he sees that the war isn't going so well. It's not going as well as he thought. And then sometime later, he has this physical breakdown. He really just, you know, his back, his digestive system, he just isn't well, and he's not sure why. But as he comes to understand it, he was in the throes of a kind of spiritual and moral crisis in rethinking everything he'd been doing, and wondering, you know, were we hitting the right targets, and what was the result? You know, what were we winning from all of this? And as he comes to doubt that, he experiences, I suggest, a form of moral injury, which is, you know, a big theme in the book, and a term that refers to witnessing or participating in acts and events that go against one's own core values.
And recurrent nightmares was something shared by several people you spoke with as well. Like, their sleep became disrupted. They dreaded going to bed at a few points in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, that is a recurrent thing. And that actually comes up in a later chapter in the book where I'm talking about folks who work on oil rigs. And one particular rigger I write about, Stephen, who survived the Deepwater Horizon blast that killed a number of his coworkers. It happened at night. He was rushed out, and he has trouble sleeping, not surprisingly, after that. In the case of drone operators, there was also this theme of sort of, you know, seeing things and images and so forth. That's not from having survived, you know, a near-death experience like the one on the rig, but it's from just, you know, having this kind of looping scroll of violent imagery that is, you know, sort of stuck in one's head enough that it makes it very difficult to disconnect.
So, Eyal, you kind of introduced this topic at the end of the last segment, so I want to devote a little bit of time now to moral injury. Can you say again what exactly is moral injury and why is that kind of an important concept to internalize for the purposes of the work you did?
Sure. So the term moral injury, I first came across it reading about military veterans. The author Jonathan Shea, a VA psychiatrist, coined the term actually in a book called Achilles in Vietnam. And in that book, he talks about how wartime trauma isn't just about fear and, you know, the danger that the soldier faces. It's also about moral questions, about what's right. And that when we violate the sense of what's right, when a soldier feels that their sense of what's right has been violated, that can create its own lasting wound that is every bit as real and every bit as serious. And he was talking about it in the context of Vietnam, where, you know, he related it to the sense of betrayal that a lot of soldiers felt, that, you know, the war was built on an edifice of lies and on a lot of misinformation and on faulty strategies and so forth. But the term more recently has gained another meaning, and it's been used again in the VA, in the military context, by people like Shira McGinn, who's based in San Francisco and has written about, you know, what happens to soldiers who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and had, say, been at a military checkpoint and had seen gunfire erupt and were unsure if, you know, an innocent person might have been hurt or and that they were in some ways, you know, they felt implicated in some way. And again, this was not, the distress here was not about fear. It was about, you know, did I witness or participate in something that goes against my fundamental values? And so that's the idea of moral injury. It's had a growing, I would say, valence within, you know, the military among veterans who have talked about it. But I try to extend it outward and suggest that it's not limited to the military, that there are a lot of jobs that in which moral injury is a risk.
If someone experiences moral injury, if they're questioning, did I do or enable something that goes against kind of the values, principles, character traits that I hold dearest, if you're questioning that, I'm assuming that it's very difficult to find the floor. I mean, do you become kind of like unmoored or untethered if you're questioning something that was kind of like a universally accepted truth or reality for you in the past?
Yeah, I think that very much is the case. And, you know, I think that, you know, to give again an example where people wouldn't think of moral injury, but I think it's there. To go back to that oil rigger, you know, when he took that job, he was, by the way, also a military veteran, but took that job and thought, you know, one thing I can rely on is that, yeah, there's danger on the rig, but all the protections are taken, all the precautions are taken to make sure that bad accidents don't happen. And after the Deepwater Horizon explosion that he survives, he starts to read about how untrue that was in offshore drilling in the U.S. That you know, in that particular case, BP and the Deepwater disaster, but really throughout the offshore oil industry, you know, the lives of the roustabouts and the lower folks who are out there on the rigs, that the precautions weren't taken. And this is a shattering realization, because it really unsettles the trust that had been there, the sense that, you know, someone was looking out for me. And once that goes, I think then a moral injury occurs. You know, there's not just, you know, I nearly died. There's someone took my life for granted and the lives of my coworkers for granted in order to make money, to cut corners. And that becomes, you know, a real source of profound distress.
So why is the term, the idea, moral injury, why is it controversial? Or maybe controversial is not the right word. Why is it not kind of universally accepted, this idea?
Well, I mean, within the military, that's very true. It is not universally accepted. And, you know, I think it's not universally accepted because I think for some people, what it suggests is that the entire military is immoral. You know, if you say that soldiers are engaged in acts that go against their core values, well, aren't you then saying the entire military is immoral? And what I sort of, you know, get at in the chapter in the drone section of the book, and when I'm talking to VA psychologists, and in particular Shira McGinn, again, who I mentioned, what she says about this is that, you know, what really matters is not, say, you know, killing in and of itself, because killing within a war is actually sanctioned. It's the story that's told about what happened and why the killing happened, right? So if you can say to yourself, well, I fired at the enemy because the enemy was firing at my buddies, that's very different than saying, you know, I really don't know why we were bombing this village in Vietnam, or for that matter, Afghanistan. And when that you know, sort of reasoning starts to, when the explanation and the story starts to not become convincing enough, then I think it opens the door to moral injury.
Why is it so often that undocumented people become kind of de facto dirty workers? Why are they so often taking up space in those jobs and those kind of sections of the economy?
Well, I talk about that quite a bit in the section of the book on poultry slaughterhouses that I wrote about, where I kept meeting undocumented workers. And tracing it back, what I, you know, concluded is really what one of these workers told to me, a guy named Juan from North Carolina, and he worked in the poultry industry. And he said, you know, every once in a while we'll have, you know, a Caucasian, a white person come in and you know, do the job on the line for a shift, and then the lunch break happens and they don't come back. And he sort of chuckled as he said this, and it was an anecdote, granted. I can't verify whether that's always true, but the point being, it's a job the conditions of which have become more and more physically difficult, the line speeds increasing, the repetitive strain injuries happening, but it's also a job where the conditions are demeaning. Where in one plant I look at, the women in the plant for a number of years complained that they were not allowed to take bathroom breaks. And when I spoke to some of these workers about that, they cried, you know, because of the assault on their dignity. You know, just think about doing a job where you are not allowed to take a bathroom break, and you're working so hard and you're straining your body, and yet you don't get that basic courtesy back. So, you know, in the case of poultry slaughterhouses, undocumented immigrants are doing this work because a lot of native-born Americans don't want to work under those conditions.
And when you look at it from another point of view, I'm assuming that if you're undocumented, you're not necessarily going to, you know, if it was available to you, maybe you wouldn't join a union. Maybe you wouldn't raise an eyebrow about pay that was subpar. Does it kind of enable the companies to, you know, just make everything run a lot cheaper?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I think that, you know, when you think about the raids on in meatpacking that took place, there were a lot of ICE raids that took place during the Trump era. And those sent a message, a very clear message to the workforce in meatpacking and in poultry slaughterhouses. You know, if you complain, you might not just lose your job, you could be deported. And so here we have, on the one hand, an industry that relies on this labor, but on the other hand, knows that the labor force can be more easily controlled and manipulated. And, you know, I think that, you know, I do quote some native-born workers who have worked in poultry who speak about this resentfully, because they say, you know, it has weakened the unions. It has made it easier for the wages to be held down. And, you know, I think there's a reality to that.
You made a really interesting point in this section devoted to the workers at meat processing plants, slaughterhouses. How does the division of labor fragment the idea of what they're doing, which is killing animals?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I talked about how, most meat eaters probably wouldn't want to look too closely at what's happening on the kill floors of a slaughterhouse. But actually, the workers themselves are sort of the job is divided up so that the actual killing of the animal is as invisible as it can be. And what I mean is, you have the live side where the animals come in, and then they are killed, often with either an electric device or a series of, devices. And then they're on the line being sort of taken around, and different people on the line do very discrete tasks, like trimming defects, things like that. And what ends up happening is that even within the slaughterhouse, the only person who actually is involved in killing, it's thought, is the knocker, the person who actually holds the gun that is aimed at the skull of a cow, or in the chicken plant, the person who, if a chicken survives that electric shock and throat slitter, they slit the throat. And I'm sorry for the graphic language, but again, the graphic language, interestingly, is almost never used. But this is graphic. This is what, happens in a slaughterhouse. And so the division of labor is one of the ways, I think, that it's made a little less the case apparent to the folks who are doing this every day.
So, do you think the pandemic has caused moral injury? I think about, the people who've had to decide who gets a ventilator when they were in short supply, or the how to stretch PPE, or who should even be admitted to a crowded hospital. Do you think that the pandemic has done this?
I mean, I was really struck. I started this book before the pandemic, well before, and I was really struck when the pandemic began that suddenly I was reading about emergency responders and doctors and nurses in hospitals having to make these excruciating moral decisions and then to live with those decisions. And it was striking to me because this is what I've been hearing from the folks I write about in the book, and who are far less visible, and who were not sort of heroized during the pandemic in the way that medical workers often were. But it struck me that, wow, we're suddenly having this conversation, which is I think a good thing. It's important to have that conversation. But I don't think we've had that conversation about, people in more hidden and less prestigious professions yet.
In your opinion, what do we owe the people doing the dirty work?
I mean, I wrote this because I think the first thing, and maybe the most important thing we owe them, is a recognition of the fact that they are doing this work, because so much of it is taking place under socially invisible conditions. So the workers themselves and the work they do is just not seen. And then I think we owe it to them to hear what they experience, to hear what they go through. I end the book with a very moving ceremony I attended about, it was actually about moral injury, in which a number of veterans spoke about things they'd done and witnessed in, fighting to defend their country and the moral injury that caused them. And then after they spoke, members of the community were asked to form a circle around them and to, in a sense, share responsibility with them for what they had just spoken about. And it was such a powerful scene, and it was such a powerful experience to be part of. And I think that's what we owe at the very least, just this sense of, these injuries, this work, it doesn't just belong to the people who do it. It's on all of us. And at the very least, we should hear from the people, our fellow citizens, who do this work.
My guest this hour was A.L. Press. He's an author and journalist, and his book is called Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. A.L., thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. And subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERAThink. You can also get the podcast on our website, where you can find out about upcoming shows. That's at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.